hear out of the loudspeaker at that frequency is what you're peaking. And all the others do not get peaked. And you don't lose the guy you're listening to because the tone is not changing in pitch as you operate the control. So it has a little bit of the characteristics of an IF shift control. It is a kind of an IF shift control. Some of the modern day receivers have that. So rather than
repeater, timeout, cancel.
So rather than go out and spend a whole lot of money for crystal filters, in some cases adding a Q multiplier is going to give you a lot of bang for the dollar. It's a tunable IF filter of a variable bandwidth. So it's a lot of hardware in one little box. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me a call at us right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
I want to say some words about the crystal filter.
Looks like there's no one else. You got it, Mel.
Okay. The crystal filter, no doubt, the mechanical crystal filter that Collins produced, is a great piece to add to any of your pieces, receivers. In fact, they're still widely popular, that basic concept. The problem of them putting it into some of the old equipment was that the limited handling capabilities of the magnetic, the magnetic circuit in it, the translucent in it. So the mechanical filters are limited to between 2 and 15 volts of RMS. They have, but you got to remember that the crystal filter had was made of discs in there that had very high Q of 1,000 or better, excess of 2,000 was easily managed in those crystal filters, those mechanical filters. They became very popular in, towards the better equipment. No doubt if you have a newer radio now and you see that the aftermarket, as they call it, another thing they get you on now, the fancy name aftermarket, is usually they give you a bunch of crystal filter that you can purchase separately for sideband CW reception, a number of them. And I can tell you, what you hear with a mechanical filter, with the Collins mechanical filter, is the ultimate in quality of receiving, especially CW would like this. Either 500 or the 250 mechanical filters take over.
Now, the Collins mechanical filter was really an acoustic device. So you have an acoustic transducer that launches the signal into one end of the filter. The little wafers in there do all of their filtering, and then the signal coming out the other end goes into another transducer where the mechanical acoustic energy gets converted back into an electrical signal, and it goes on to the next stage of the IF. And you said that they're rated for 2 volts to 15 volts RMS into the transducer. My guess is if you exceeded 15 volts, you were into a nonlinear mode where possibly you could damage the mechanical resonator. And if you were lower in the 2 volts, my guess is the signal-to-noise ratio would suffer. Is that approximately correct, Mel? Go ahead.
The mechanical filter is actually considered a three-section type of device by Collins' description. It has the input transducer, a mechanically resonant filter section, and then the output transducer. That's the way it was originally described by Collins. For frequencies below 1 megahertz, called the three section. It was actually described as a three section system takeover.
And it really was the early equivalent of a SAW device, surface acoustic wave. Your input transducer, I am guessing, was a kind of piezoelectric material, that took the input electrical signal, converted it into mechanical motion that went through the filtering section, and then the mechanical motion coming out of that filtering section went into another piezoelectric section that converted mechanical energy back into electrical energy. Very crafty. Was the crystal filter, Collins crystal filter, about 4 inches long and 1.5 inches square? Is that the approximate size of the actual device itself? Mel, go ahead.
No, actually, the original ones, like are in my Collins 7584 and the KWS-1, look like cartridge fuses. You can picture like a 100-amp cartridge fuse. In fact, the clip that it fits into, it's just like a cartridge fuse pushed into those two spring clips. They look exactly the same in the receiver or the transmitter. It looks like you could put a cartridge fuse right in place of it. Or you could take your cartridge, take your mechanical filter and stick it into your box there. I'm just joking. But no, that's what it basically looked like. It was round in shape and just plugged in that method. Yeah, actually, it was, as Collins originally described it, it was called magnostriction. I believe that's the way it was pronounced. It was MAGNOSTRICTION. I believe it's pronounced magnostriction. That converts electrical energy, no, the electrical signal to a mechanical energy, and then back again after going through it. That's the original description by Collins, over.
I've worked with something similar called magnetostriction. I think nickel rods are used in a ultrasonic transducer, and that operates by magnetostriction. The nickel rods, when subjected to a magnetic field, will mechanically change their length. And so if you do it at, say, for instance, a 100 kc rate, it makes 100 kc acoustic energy that moves the bottom of your pan with some fluid in there, and you're doing a little ultrasonic cleaning. So that effect is called magnetostriction. It changes shape as a function of magnetic field. And so maybe the Collins did that as opposed to piezoelectric. So it's a kind of a saw device or a magnetic surface acoustic wave. More saw. There's a bunch of these filtering-like characteristics that are used these days. Saw filters are a rather modern-day science where with saw technology, surface acoustic waves, you can synthesize in a fairly small, simple-looking circuit, 30, 40, 50 poles of a filter can be synthesized, and the whole thing will take up an extremely small fraction of an inch in length and width and height. So they take up very little volume and can give you a lot of filtering action. And the last I knew, saw devices were good up to center frequencies of a couple of gigahertz. It's kind of hard to believe that you can make acoustic energy operate at 1,000 megacycles, but that's what they're doing with saw devices. And it is acoustic energy flowing across those filter elements. Pretty fancy stuff. Maybe it's time that we open up the mailbag, Mel. And if so, once again, I'm going to repeat the fact that the main purpose of this particular technical net is a gathering the clan, live performance gathering. Various people hear what Mel and Dick and our questioners are asking and saying, and various people in the audience will say, yep, I got some knowledge on that one. Go to the man in Florida, and he'll help you fix your AC receiver. This is a good example. So live performance is the main purpose of this TechNet. Mel, out of the kindness of his heart, is saying that a small number of written questions of a general nature, particularly for a person who doesn't yet have his ham license, will be accommodated. But if you are about to write an elaborate email to Mel and hand him your doctoral thesis, your master's thesis. That is in a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
That is very inappropriate. If you're about to hand him your electronic circuits course in college, homework, very inappropriate. The majority of what Mel gets, in my mind, is inappropriate material. We never volunteered to do that. We never volunteered to give a completely free, written, consulting service. That's not what is offered here. So you write a letter to Mel or Dick, there's a high probability you will not get an answer. We're not making a promise in that area. If Mel gets an extra time, he'll answer some letters, particularly from people who don't yet have their license. If you really have a question you want answered, find a ham radio operator that can sign into the SecNet and ask your question live when the clan has gathered, when the group of experts is there. That's when you get the best possible answer. You may have the mistaken impression that Mel and Dick think that they're experts on everything. They're not. A hell of a lot of what you're hearing is the help of their friends. So for you guys to write ridiculously long things, I mean, some people will write Mel a letter of multiple pages listing every single possible rig he can buy and ask for a marketing survey of new equipment and say which one should he buy. Or people will list for us everything they own and say, how can I make the best use out of this? If you think about it, the person is asking you to live his life for him. Not reasonable. So don't get mad at us if you don't get an answer. It was not promised, per se. I may be a little bit severe, but I think you get the point of what I'm saying. Maybe Mel's going to add or subtract from that. And to K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, says K2KEY. Really, that's true. I know that these people are thinking quite a bit about, you know, our ability, Dick, to send us a thesis of this type. As I spoke to you, when I spoke to you on the phone, I told you what the details on some of these, I should say, pages or complete, complete manuscript, I guess you would have to call it, because some of them are phenomenal. I've got them in the mail. I told you I had it sent back. It weighed a half a pound, this thing. And it was quite a feat into engineering and all. And I know you and I just couldn't sit down and possibly go through this line by line. I mean, this is something that, for somebody that's strictly, you know, does that as their profession, and, you know, proofread things like this. But I thank the person for his confidence that he felt that we could, you know, handle this type of level. At that point, I touched about the best way I could let it go. As you mentioned, SAW, stress acoustical wave type devices. I'm just going to say a word or two about that. They actually had their derivation. They alluded to that many years ago, and there really were experiments in a type of device called the phasing crystal doses that you saw show up at the last of the old receivers used employing vacuum tubes or valves, some people refer to them, I guess, in Europe. And so they had, in those, they were using what was known as, they had phasing crystal filter circuits in there, which was another type of supposedly good filtering, the method for filtering and obtaining, you know, more or less high selectivity. They were really adjusted right. You could, you know, obtain improved selectivity in the receiver. But that was based on the piezoelectric, you know, quartz crystal type of device. Whereas, again, mechanical filter was that thick set of magneto resonance, the magneto strip circuit, In other words, converting electrical into mechanical, or mechanical to electrical back again. So that was really the derivation of the building. I'm just looking through some stuff in the meantime. Okay, I got one here. Hold on.
Hello?
Yes, Jim? Yes, sir.
Hello? Okay.
Just saying something about, you know, maybe some stuff a little far advanced. Okay, I just seen this thing here. I don't know if this is even, you could discuss this. What the heck? I haven't heard of it. What is a gravity wave communication that is, that was maybe employed for space communication? I just happen to see this for space communication. Is there a experiment into, gravity wave communication? Do you know anything about this, Dick? Over.
A very small amount. I've attended two separate lectures at Stony Brook University. The very first Friday of each month at Stony Brook University in the Earth and Space Science Center, in conference room number 1 or 101, I think it's called, which holds 300 people in seats and a standing room. I guess you can get 350, 400 people in that room. First Friday of every month, starting at 7:30, during the time that classes are in session, the astronomy group at Stony Brook will give a lecture. And of course, the astronomy group, when they give a lecture on black holes, boy, they fill up the place. And the LIGO, I think it was called, the gravity wave detecting device that's being built in the Texas, Oklahoma area. This is a very fancy laser beam through a multiple mile evacuated tunnel, and you bounce the signal back and forth, and if a gamma ray burst or some other major event in space takes place, it is believed that a gravity wave is transmitted, and that that gravity wave can be received to detect the magnitude, the direction of arrival, and find out in one direction of space did a major event take place, a supernova or whatever. It is believed that gravity is a wave that propagates at something like the speed of light. And it has very far-reaching characteristics. If a person could find a way of modulating a gravity wave, it may be an extremely good way of doing extraterrestrial communication. That's a belief. So there's been a number of experiments. One of them was to take an extremely large chunk of aluminum and put strain gauges on it, on the assumption that when a gravity wave came by, the aluminum would shrink or stretch a little bit, and the strain gauges would pick it up. That was not very successful. This laser gravity wave detector is a much more robust approach, and the only problem they're running into with that one, let me drop, is that you have this multiple mile long tunnel with evacuated tube, air is taken out, and you have fancy mirrors on both ends, and you reflect the signal back and forth from the laser multiple times, and the belief is that the length of the tube will change when the gravity wave comes by, and you've got one north-south and one east-west so that you can determine the direction of arrival. However, when a railroad train comes by a couple of miles away, it literally bends the surface of the Earth. And this gravity wave detector is looking for a very minor change in length as a kind of microscopic interferometer of the signal that's going down the tube. And so it gets a false alarm. Well, you can eventually teach it the signature of a train passing by. A buddy of mine used to work on the laser interferometer, which was a very precise distance measuring device that went out something like 50 feet, as I remember, and it would measure to the nearest micro inch out to 50 feet. And when you would set this up across a lathe bed, because you're using a very precise lathe that made machine parts for, say, the wing of a supersonic airplane, I remember if somebody opened a door and a puff of warm air came along, it would change the velocity of propagation of the wave between the laser emitter and the corner reflector, that was downrange, and you're measuring the distance between the two very precisely. Or again, if a train went by, or if somebody used an overhead crane in the building, they would literally be bending the building and bending the ground around it. In this case, the barometer would sense that. So gravity waves and things like that are kind of a fun piece of very basic science. To my knowledge, no extraterrestrial gravity waves have been detected yet, but that project is proceeding at a pretty nice pace, and I know that they're making progress. So if there really is a gravity wave, as is proposed, as is postulated, there is work in the United States, and I think in Europe also, to detect it. Next email, KQKEY, KQRIW.
Gravity does not exist. It is an invention, exactly like time and terrenium.
Okay, Alex. So, Alex, to your knowledge, you're saying it's not just a hypothesis. You're convinced it's a reality, and you might be right. To your knowledge, Alex, has anyone had any success in detecting a gravity wave at this time? Over to you, Alex.
What I'm saying it is that gravity does not exist. Just think about the Newton's apple. What if the Newton's apple, the apple itself, hit the head? Or, well, basically the question is, what hit? The apple hit the head, or the head hit the apple? Then you will understand what I'm saying.
Okay, from one point of view, it's relativism. Whether his head hit the apple or the apple hit the head, with reference to those two objects, it almost doesn't matter. And did the apple really strike his head? Well, there's a yes and a no to that. If you get down to the microscopic level, the outer molecules of that apple and the outer molecules of Newton's head have these electron cloud around them, which has an extremely strong electrostatic repulsion. As such, the apple molecules and the head molecules got extremely close to each other, but they did not physically touch. However, they got so close and they deflected each other that for all practical purposes, they did touch. That's one way of looking at it. But yes, because of the local gravity wave, from one point of view, sucking the two objects together, Newton's head and the apple, they did strike each other. It is my belief the apple did 99% of the moving, and Newton's head only did 1% of the moving. But that's a belief. You might just disagree with that one, Alex. N2, NNU, K2RIW.
Yeah, I certainly disagree with that. I will say that Newton's head hit the apple. It was traveling through space at 18,000 miles a second, or what is that, the speed of 18,000 miles an hour? No, a second. The speed of Earth. And when the apple became dislocated from the branch, it just floated into the universe. Nothing to keep it connected to the Earth anymore. So this is why the Newton's head hits the apple and not vice versa.
Okay, it's just a matter of a point of view. Yeah, we're moving through space at something like 18 miles a second in our orbit around the sun, and the sun itself is translating through the galaxy at a ridiculously high rate. There's all kinds of motions going on. 1,000 miles an hour is the rate at which you're moving because the Earth is rotating when you're standing at the equator. That's around 1,000 miles an hour. The whole Earth is going around the sun at something like 19 miles a second. The whole sun and solar system is moving through the galactic arm at some particular rate, such that we make one complete circuit around the galaxy center. I think it's every 260 million years, every quarter of a billion years, our solar system makes one complete loop of this galaxy. The galaxy itself is a member of a local group of galaxies, and we're moving with reference to that local group, and the whole group is translating itself through space. There's all kinds of motions going on here. So when it comes to velocity, oh boy, you can have a grand old time with this one, adding all those individual numbers together in a vector manner. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to gravity wave detection. It would be kind of nice. because once you detect the waves themselves, you're one step closer to understanding the phenomena by which you might be able to generate them and modulate them. And they might be a lot easier to send very long distances than radio waves. They might actually have a wavelength to them. There's all kinds of portions of the spectrum here to talk about. We talk about DC to light, DC to gamma ray, and where do gravity waves list, where do they find themselves in that spectrum of all possible frequencies that can be transmitted and received? Is it a brand new method of transmission? Probably so. Everything we know about gravity implies that it's an extremely strong small force until you have extremely large objects. In theory, you can take two bowling balls and with careful laboratory measurement, hang them both from a wire, and you can measure the gravity of attraction between the two bowling balls. But it takes a very sensitive measurement because that amount of gravity is a very small number, but it's real, and it has been measured. Mr. Cavendish was one of the first guys who did that measurement, and in fact, the measurement he made was heavily contaminated by his very presence. He was a great big 300-pound man. He forgot to correct for the fact that his body nearby was affecting the measurement he was making. Mel wouldn't have that problem. He's a svelte guy. He would have nowhere near as much gravity to those two bowling balls. KQKEY. KQLIW. WSLAN.
Repeater. Time out.
Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
Repeater. Time out.
Cancel.
Repeater.
Time out. Cancel.
Repeater.
Time out.
Okay. I heard you on the input, Paul. Why don't you repeat your message? The machine just timed out. Say it again, Paul.
Okay, Dick. I've been trying to get through the Southern machine. That hasn't worked. I think there must be a little delay in there. But, I just wanted to comment about going back to the LIGO experiments. That's what they would call LIGO. There's a way to get around that train problem. They knew they were going to have that problem. They set up one, I think, down in Texas, but the other one is in the state of Washington. So there's two complete setups. These things that you described, you know, going at right angles. So they have one detector set up down south and another one up north, and then this way they, you know, if one of them gets zapped and the other one gets zapped, a fraction of a second later, but you know, almost virtually at the same time, that they'll know it's a real reading and not some anomaly. Back to you, Dick.
And from your knowledge, Paul, have the LIGO experimental packages been completed in construction? And I think they're now just tuning them up, and I guess they haven't detected anything yet, otherwise there would have been a eureka announcement in one of the good magazines, like Scientific American, Science Magazine, or whatever. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, to my knowledge, not one gravity wave has ever been detected there from out of space. They're going to have a tough time. You know, I think the Earth tends to interfere with it. I think they need to get these things space-borne, you know, and get these things away from planets. I think it's going to be a tough detection to try to do something like that. But yeah, based on the theory, they should do it. If a star winked out, you know, like a supermassive a supernova or any kind of nova or anything that tends to change in space one way or the other and lose gravity. With a supernova, they do lose a lot of gravity. It gets blown out in space. They should be able to detect something like that if it exists. And they even said, you know, if the sun blinks out and disappears, the Earth will not change its orbit for another 8 minutes. So, you know, then as the Earth changes its orbit, I guess you could say, well, that's the way to detect it. But I think that would be a long wait to wait for something like that to happen. Back here.
I was reading one of the Scientific American articles that you go into their website a couple of hours ago, and someone had asked the question, what would happen to the Earth's orbit if our sun, our local star, had suddenly turned into a black hole? And the answer is nothing. First of all, we don't have enough mass in that sun to become a black hole, but in this hypothetical experiment, if the sun did suddenly become a black hole, it would be squeezed down to an extremely small object that would be dark, but the exact same amount of mass would be present. And because gravity in general acts as a central force motion phenomenon, in other words, when you're calculating the orbit of a satellite going around the Earth, you could take all of the mass of the Earth, which is creating Earth's local gravity, and you can make it theoretically into a point source. You can, in your model, you can squeeze down all the mass of the Earth to one tiny little dot at the center of where the Earth presently is, and you get the exact same orbit of all of your satellites. And you could do that calculation. The next level of sophistication of your model would be to include the mass concentration. You've got a local mass concentration in the southern Pacific, and you've got another one in the southern Atlantic. So the Earth is not a uniform mass material. But if it was, you could completely represent it with a point source. So when you get a nova or supernova, even though all of that material is being blasted into all directions in space, in the far field where we are, there still is approximately the same amount of mass present. Therefore, the amount of local gravity is going to be almost the same, with one exception. And that is this great big shock wave that's created of ultraviolet, X-ray, and whatever radiation represents emitted energy. And by the Einstein equivalent, E equals mc squared, energy mass equivalent, an extremely small percentage of the mass that used to be there that converted into energy, and it got radiated. So yes, there's a slight decrease in mass. But I'm suspected that small amount of decrease is not only percentage-wise so small, and it's beyond many light years or billions of light years away. Detecting that local change in gravity strikes me as an extremely difficult problem. But you'll never know if you don't run the experiment. If you don't start the search, you'll never know whether that wood contains, whether that particular wood contains a pink elephant. You have to make the leap of faith there could be one there, and you start searching for it. That's sort of where they are with gravity waves. Make the leap of faith that they could be there, they could be...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So those gravity waves could be there, they could be detectable. You set up the experiment, you align the hardware, and you go looking for the effect. You hope you find it. And even if you don't find it, all the failures and successes you'll have in the process of producing the hardware will give you other fallout pieces of knowledge. Every dollar we spend at NASA gives us something like a 5-to-1 fallout in jobs that people have in the United States, things that we discover. And those fallouts, sort of side effects, you could call them, turn into, in many cases, commercial products. That computer that's in your pocket, that science got advanced a whole lot by the Apollo program. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. They needed real good navigation computers to do all that fancy work in space. That's just one of a thousand possible examples. K2KEY. That's quite a question you got there, Mel. K2LAW.
Okay. You know, John Krause, now that I remember that, had it just attracted my attention because, like I say, he was a gentleman. And I remember him making a statement. I think he had one time a talk on gravity waves. And if I'm not mistaken, Dick, he said it wasn't practical for the one reason that he considered the, how did he put it? That gravity wave would actually be equivalent to a transmission line through space, and that the characteristic of heat would be close to a short circuit, so that this would be, you said that the, that means that the, we would have to, with a situation incredibly forward beam, that's why you can't, you're never going to be able to receive it. I think I'm just, you know, paraphrasing what he said, but I can almost visualize him saying that, something to that effect, Dick, over.
Fascinating. Did you have a course with him, or because he was number one in the antenna world, wrote the very first Bible on the subject, the book called Antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill, and it's now in its third or fourth edition. At least I own the third edition. So did you seek him out and strike up a conversation with him? One other friend of mine did that also, by the way. Or did you take a course with him, Mel? Go ahead.
They had quite an intensive investigation going on there at all University of Ohio with that interferometry system. So he was very involved with that. And no, I didn't have him directly as a professor of electrical engineering, except that he was constantly, had a number of different talks that I sat in on, very fascinating talks. And basically, you know, I was interested in getting my sheet, and as they say, getting out of there so I could earn a living. But if it stuck around there, I'll tell you something, he could have gotten one heck of an education there with between John Krause and a few other of the antenna so-called, I can call them maintenance, that were working there in on that interferometry, that famous interferometry system that supposedly did detect something unusual from outer space, but they had a big sheet of it hanging up there and on the wall, and say, you know, with its in large capital letters, with an arrow pointing to the so-called WOW, the WOW signal, Dick, over.
I might have a question. If we're talking about gravity, I would like to somebody to answer to me this question.
Okay, we're going to pick you up in a second there, Alex. Alex, the WOW signal, if you hold it upside down, it's the MOM signal, M-O-M. And the way that Ohio University radio telescope was set up, they had two separate horns, and because of the rate of rotation of the Earth, if a signal passed through the first horn and then the second horn, it would see the signal twice with an extremely exact timing between the two, and that WOW signal fulfilled that requirement. It was an extraterrestrial source that had just the right timing between the two horns. So they knew it wasn't just a phony signal. It was something out there at a fixed position in space radiating a strong signal. And it wasn't a geosynchronous satellite because that wouldn't have walked through the two horns. It wasn't a low Earth, LEO, low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit satellite because the rate would have been wrong. So there was some fixed object out in space that emitted a strong signal. Now, the possibility exists with modern-day knowledge that that was a gamma-ray burst. The gamma-ray bursts that we get from space are an amount of energy that I'm going to give you a repeat on that one, and then I'm going to turn it over to Alex. But first, let me drop and give you a repeat on what a gamma-ray burst is. For a long period of time, they were getting these gamma-ray bursts, first detected with the VELA, V-E-L-A satellite. We have a whole constellation of those to monitor whether or not the strategic arms agreements are being properly honored. You start using nuclear weapons, even in underground tests, you're emitting gamma rays that get detected by those satellites, and so the whole world knows about it, so to speak. Okay, these gamma ray bursts were being picked up by the satellites, and they soon discovered it wasn't coming from an earthbound source. Tremendous amounts of energy, and at first they thought it must have been very nearby. Well, they soon discovered that almost all of the gamma ray bursts were in some other galaxy, very far away. Our sun puts out 10 to the 27 watts of energy. One with 27 zeros after it is the number of watts that the sun is emitting right now. And it's going to do it for 10 billion years. A watt is a joule per second. Go through the mathematics. 10 to the 43 joules, one with 43 zeros after it, is the total amount of energy that our sun will put out in a 10 billion year. 5 billion year period. We're 5 billion years into the Earth, into the Sun's age. We got 5 billion years to go. Rough numbers. Okay? In the case of a gamma ray burst, something happens in space that amount of energy, 10 to the 43 joules, comes out of that event in a period of time, not of 10 billion years. You get all of that energy in 1 second. Is that a big bang? Wow. That's just out of sight. It may be 2 or 3 seconds in some cases, but in an extremely short period of time, you get that amount of energy. That amount of energy goes really from DC to light. Goes across a very wide spectrum of low, medium, and high, short, and long wavelengths, low and high frequencies. And you can detect it with all kinds of telescopes and whatever, if you can steer them to the right spot fast enough, and you can see the afterglow. And there's now been a few of those events. So my first guess as to what was the wow experiment, what was the wow event, is something like a gamma ray burst. Just happened to be in the beam of that antenna during that period of time. And they were looking at the radio signal, L-band, John Krause's radio telescope works at 1420 megacycles, is one of its main frequencies. So at 1420 megacycles, a very low frequency as far as radio astronomy is concerned, you get a very long afterglow that lasts for a few hours. So as the Earth swept through that, on the very first time they measured the WOW experiment, that's what they saw, is my guess. That's a pure guess. And they looked a day later, a week later, a month later, and no longer saw it, because the afterglow was over. Because the afterglow was already gone. That's a guess on my part. So, was it a extraterrestrial communication? Maybe not. But, fascinating. It's discouraging that that beautiful, great big radio telescope in Miami, Ohio, had to be taken apart because they lost the lease on the land and the local builder wanted to use the land for something else. So they had to take that radio telescope apart. Over to you, Alex. I think you said you had a question on something like this. N2, November Uniform, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. 10 to the 43. Wow, that's a lot of energy. That must make Gore very, very happy. And if you stop thinking about it's approaching our national debt as a number. Well, that's just a joke. Well, the question that arises when we're talking about gravity is when you're trying to find information about it and trying to understand what that's all about it, everybody tries to depict it as a mesh of wire, a very nice little square, with a ball in it, a ball that actually deforms the mesh and produces a dimple where the ball is. And the explanation is, well, this is what gravity is doing. It's just distorting the space and around it. And I'm not sure what they're trying to tell me with that. Are they trying to tell me that our universe is flat and it doesn't have volume? It's a two-dimensional universe that they're talking about? Otherwise, we should talk about the void around our Earth or any other stellar mass, and not a dimple. Something doesn't fit here in my mind. Back to Dick.
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here, Alex. I am convinced that all of space is at least three-dimensional, length, width, height. Fourth-dimensional if you want to include time. And then you can include a whole lot more dimensions. So it's at least three-dimensional, physically speaking, in my mind. When they draw these flat surfaces that have a dimple, which represents the place where a planet is, which gives you a local warping of space because of that local gravity field, that is a representation of the local gravity field. It doesn't mean that space is two-dimensional. In every single point in three-dimensional space, for every little point that has an X, Y, and Z location, or address, you and I could, in theory, draw a vector that represents the magnitude and the direction of the gravity field at that point. And we can do the same thing with the electrostatic field. The electric field at that point in XYZ space has got a particular direction and magnitude which can be drawn. Little bitty arrows at each one of these little points in space. And when you've got a local object that creates gravity, something as massive as the Earth, it is creating a variation of those vectors that have a different pattern to them, sort of like an antenna pattern. And if you made, if you crushed all of space down to two dimensions in that area, and you represented it as up and down, you get this warped-looking thing that looks like a Mexican hat, if you know what I mean, or an upside-down Mexican hat. So it is a representation of a local gravity field or a local E field, is what I think they're trying to show you. But I'm pretty sure they're not trying to say that space is two-dimensional. There are people who try to simplify things that way to make a certain point. But I'm convinced space is, physically speaking, at least three-dimensional. That's an opinion. Back to you, Alex.
WS2NZ.
Paul recognized Alex first. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I know it's an opinion, and most of what we're discussing here are opinions because we don't even know that gravity exists. However, the depiction of it is totally false, and in no documentation you can see a hollow space between the world, between the star or the world or whatever it is, and the separate and the other mass. If this is so, another question arises. Now there are 10,000 so questions. What is that space between Earth and the space now that is deformed filled with? Is it just empty, or it does have something in it? So all kind of crazy stuff, right? I think we leave the discussion to the people that paid to do that, because there is nonsensical everything that we're thinking about gravity. As long as we don't know it, even if it does exist, and cool and anyway.
I think I see where you're going here. I had a more fundamental problem way back in the early 70s. I set up electronic equipment in Farmingdale, Long Island, with a homebrew 12-foot dish that you can see on the front cover of the August issue of August issue of QSC magazine, August 1972. On the front cover, you'll see me standing in front of the dish, and I use that dish to listen to the Apollo 15 astronaut and Apollo 16 astronauts, roughly 1971. I know that between the Earth and the Moon, there is nothing but an extremely hard vacuum. Particle-wise, in theory, nothing is there. An astronaut on the Moon turned on a transmitter, aimed his antenna at the Earth. Electrons flowed through that antenna. The electrons set up a magnetic field. And the magnetic field created this electromagnetic wave that went through that hard vacuum of space, came down to my antenna in Farmingdale. I picked up a millionth of a billionth of a watt of that signal, amplified it with a parametric amplifier, and eventually came out of the loudspeaker, and I'm listening to astronaut audio from a quarter of a million miles away, 1.5 seconds, 1.25 seconds of delay time. I know that that empty chunk of space between Moon and Earth contained nothing before he turned on that transmitter. I know that not one single electron left that antenna, as far as the signal is concerned. This electromagnetic wave went through space, energy got transmitted, and I received it. I know how to calculate it. I know what direction. I know what antenna pattern. I know all of these things from experiential evidence. I still don't know what the heck it was. You start off with nothingness. In the middle of the experiment, you have nothingness. At the end of the experiment, you have nothingness. And yet energy went through that nothingness. And we give it some great words, but I don't know what it is. I'm kind of mystified by that. But Paul's going to straighten this all out for us. That US2N, the man with the answer, K2RIW. I'm calling with you, Paul.
Well, just a second, please.
Go ahead, Alex.
There is a famous physician, his name is Higgs, H-I-G-G-S. If you read him, you will understand what is between Earth and the Moon. There is no such thing as a void. Okay, that's enough. We can argue about that until tomorrow, so let's let some other people to have the floor here. And to enemy.
So those Higgs particles, that's what did it. Hey, Paul, you got the floor. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, those Higgs particles. They're the ones that they're going to look for with that collider in CERN, out in Switzerland, once they turn that on. That should be ready to go soon. That I want to see. That's another topic. No, I just wanted to mention a lot of the drawings you see in books, they'll show a sphere, you know, the Earth, the Sun, or whatever. You take the Earth and you put it in the center of the page, and you see lines going through, you know, vertically, horizontally, and also Z location. So you'll see three sets of lines going through the page, so you look at a two-dimensional page. So it's like a 3D picture, and all those lines are curving to the sphere that they have depicted in the middle of the page. So that's their proper description of how it's warping space. The bowling ball on the blanket theory, you know, that's just a concept to somebody that's really not ready to handle the three dimensions. That's what I think. A lot of your drawings are depicted in 3D to show the curvature of space.
And it's the space-time continuum that's being warped. Great-sounding words, but mystical-sounding words. And what it really means, I got a fuzzy feeling that I don't really know. Mel's going to straighten it out first. What's the next question out of his mailbag? K2KEY, H-U-L-I-W.
Star Trek word, W-2-T-N-J.
They sure are. Beam me down, Scotty. I'm not sure there's a diligent wife up here.
What is Q?
What is Q? Right at the Mel read this next email, we'll try to describe Q. It's got four definitions. You got to know.
Okay, this is K2KY. Well, the final word on this business with the WOW signal. It was actually analyzed by a number of scientists that were called in. And the final determination I was reading is that it actually took place in August 15, 1977, and they said because of the duration of the signal of at least 1 minute that it was definitely of intelligent origin, and it was somewhere near or somewhere in the vicinity, the distance of the Moon. That was the final determination on the WOW signal they ruled out that late years also discussed whether they came up with this in late years, but they had ruled out that it was kind of a, you know, gamma burst or something like that, because of the correct repetition rate of it. Anyhow, okay, so that's the story. Gravity waves. No, whatever. L Network. Okay, question person. He says you have mentioned that the way to go in matching the loop is to build your own Luna. And you mentioned that there are several different L network configurations. Tell me, what did you do to decide on which one to use? I'm very fascinated with loop antenna, and heard so many of them on the air, and I'd like to know really what type of tuning system should I look to construct from scratch, being that the commercial tuners are really not the ideal way to go. Okay. Would you like to pick up on that? Take over.
Yes, I would. There's a number of answers to this one, Mel. You're going to give an answer, I'm going to give an answer, and maybe even Alex will give another answer. With modern day impedance matching or impedance measuring networks that you and I can buy, whether it be a real network analyzer or the poor man's equivalent, you can find out what impedance is hanging at the end of your piece of coaxial cable. You've hung an antenna out there, hopefully you've resonated it, but even if you didn't resonate it, that's not a requirement, it just makes things a little bit easier. But hook or by crook, you can measure the impedance of your antenna. It requires a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of skill. You can do it with very simple techniques, or you can go out and buy an impedance measuring bridge of some kind, a network analyzer, or so on. So once you know the impedance of your antenna, I'm going to pick a number. Let's assume it's 250 ohms of resistance with 420 ohms of capacitor reactance. That is the impedance of my antenna at this infinite time. One possible solution that I have used a lot of times in the last few months, very successfully, is Berkeley. You go to Google and you use this as search word. Impedance match plus Berkeley. B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y. Berkeley University in California has this beautiful website where they say, okay, what is the characteristic impedance of your transmission line? Usually you're going to write down 50 ohms. What is the impedance of your load? In my case, I would plug in 250 ohms of positive resistance and 420 ohms of negative capacitor reactance. Capacitance is negative, inductive is positive. If you give it those three numbers, 50 ohms, 250, and 420, and then you press calculate, and it gives you nine diagrams. Four L networks, two or three or four pi networks, a couple of T networks, and whatever. It gives you all of those answers simultaneously. Printed across the page. Beautiful diagram. Right alongside of it, it tells you what values to put into each one of those LC locations to get that network to work. It'll tell you whether or not that network is appropriate or not appropriate. The nine answers they give you, I call them Berkeley number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I select the one that either has the minimum components or is the easiest topography to use in my particular location, my particular application. Did you have? So, some of them will have negative values in there. Maybe one of them might require a negative capacitor, and I know darn well that that's a network that doesn't work. That topography for that particular piece doesn't work. So it's easy to know the ones that don't work. And each one of the answers it gives you, it tells you what capacitor value, what inductor value, in picofarads and nanohenries accordingly. Oh, by the way, it also asks you what frequency you're operating at. And it gives the answers in picofarads and nanohenries if you're up at 1 gigahertz, which is where I do most of my work. And it also tells you what is the Q of the network if you set up that exact network that it calculated for you. So a mountain of work is done in 1 second if you give it that raw data and you press calculate. That's one very convenient solution that I've used, as I said, quite a number of times in the last couple of months. And I'm willing to kiss that screen every time because it works so well. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Very good, Nick. Well, what they're actually alluding to is what the experiment with full-wave loops have more or less determined, such as most of the agreement is that 600 ohm wire feeders is better than going, say, down up there at the loop and then coming down with coax. Now, there were several, you know, as they say, several basic L network considerations or configurations. You know, eventually it settled down to what I'll describe, but, you know, it's either impedance step down, a high pass type of, it may go through them for the people that just quite maybe can't grasp this. I'll try to basically start out with a description of the four basic L networks, I guess, that should be considered. There's impedance step down called the high pass. There's a people step down called the low pass. there's a mean step-up called the high pass, and there's a mean step-up called the low pass. This becomes a combination of what I finally came up with. But that is basically the four types of basic L network configurations. I think that's the simplest way I can describe basically what you're dealing with balanced inputs, Jacob. Am I missing something? Over.
Okay, you said balanced inputs, and maybe you mean unbalanced. I mean, if you were doing it with coax, one terminal is ground and one terminal is hot. And if the first thing you go into an inductor that's in series, and then the next component is a capacitor shunting to ground, and the junction of the two is the output, you and I would call that an L network, and that would be a low pass. Because a series inductor, shunt capacitor, low frequencies go through that very well, high frequencies get shunted to ground. So that's what low pass means when Mel says low pass. And the series and the shunt element, you look at them on a schematic diagram, they form an L. So that's a low pass L. A high pass L would have series capacitor followed by a shunt inductor to ground at passing high frequencies. And now, you now know what low pass and high pass is, and whether or not the shunt capacitor is first or second determines whether or not it is a step up or step down. When the junction between the two elements, series element and the shunt element, when the junction between the two is the output, that's an impedance step up. When the junction of the two elements is connected to the input, then that's an impedance step down. So those four Berkeley configurations, low and high pass, step up and step down, those four combinations, are the first solutions that you get on that page out of the Berkeley program. By the way, when you look that up on Google, you write down the words impedance space match space plus sign space Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, and it will find that beautiful program for you. You go to it, and boy, it gives you a beautiful number of solutions immediately with five decimal places of accuracy. What more do you want? It does a tremendous amount of work for you in 1 second. Beautiful diagram, nice layout. You know exactly what you got. There's no ambiguity to it. Very well done program. Those guys are geniuses out there in California. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Okay, this is KEY. What basically for non-balanced systems, as you described it, those are the four basics. But for the balanced system that is desired on a loop antenna, what we did, instead of going through any one using this, you're actually looking to feed the loop with coax cable in some way. What I was, again, saying is that with all the